and welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today, Michael Barbieri, Director of the Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health for the state of Delaware. And welcome. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you. I'm glad you're willing to hear us talk.
Well, this was prompted by one of your own press releases, actually, with a spike in recent overdoses with opioid abuse. Tell us briefly, how is opioid abuse affecting the state of Delaware right now?
Well, I think opioid abuse is affecting the state of Delaware, you know, very significantly. I mean, last year we had 308 deaths, not all opiate, but overdose deaths. So we had 308 of those last year. That's up from the, you know, high twos the year before. So it's a growing concern. It's also an issue that affects so many different parts of our lives. Obviously, it affects the family, affects the individual, obviously, affects the family, affects community because you start seeing more, you know, nuisance crimes being committed. It affects our healthcare system because oftentimes these individuals will enter into the emergency room for an overdose, will be resuscitated and go back out into the community and, you know, continue along the path. So, I mean, overall, it's a financial, it's a financial burden, it's a social burden, it's a familial burden. So it affects every part of our lives. And it's important that we address this and look at this as, you know, again, a multi-pronged way. We have to look at how we work with the individual. And then how do we also work with the community to provide the supports for that individual to be able to enter into and maintain recovery, work with the family to help them to understand how they better deal with that individual.
You started off by saying deaths and overdoses, and then you corrected it. It wasn't all opioid. Is this the growing area that we have to worry about, or do we have other issues? What are we abusing right now?
Well, opiates seem to be the drug most abused right now, and it's been for the last several years that the opiates have been abused. Now, a big problem with that is, again, they're easily accessible and they're cheap. And easily accessible, you know, prior to just recently, they used to be easily accessible from a physician for any type of pain. You know, if a person got a tooth extract, that they would have several days of opiates prescribed. If you had surgery, you'd have opiates. And the problem with that is not everyone wants to take those drugs over the extended period of time because the pain subsides. So they would put those drugs in their medicine cabinet and they would easily then find their way back out into the community. Others would start taking it and they get relief from the pain and other things. So they continue to take it and then keep on, again, continuing to request more, and they would be getting more and more of the opiate, and they become addicted to the opiate. Once we saw that happening, quite honestly, physicians said, you know, this is beyond what I should be prescribing, and they stopped. And, you know, again, with the PDMP, which is a drug monitoring program, physicians realized they had to, you know, be much more judicious in this. So they stopped prescribing, and the person who still felt they had the pain would find that relief on the streets by either purchasing the opiate on the streets or turning to heroin. So across the board, this problem has continued to grow. It was no longer just something that was in an urban community hitting the poor where people are, you know, strewn out on the streets injecting opiates, but it started to become, you know, much broader than that, hitting all socioeconomic classes. And those people then starting to turn to the streets and purchasing heroin.
It sounds like we are faulting the medical profession for this. It doesn't start recreationally like marijuana or a peer situation with pills and hallucinogens, et cetera.
Well, let me clarify that. I definitely don't want to fault the medical society, the medical profession. I think several years ago, it was decided that pain became, I think they call that the fifth issue in a person's health, you know, how much pain are you managing? And doctors became very sensitive to helping people manage pain. Coincident with that, pharmaceutical companies, you know, presented this drug, oxycodone, that was very good in dealing with pain and suggested that it was not addictive. So I think in trying to help, and I believe it was truly out of effort to help and assist and to reduce pain, one started getting involved in opiates. Okay, so that's one path of entry into the addiction. The other path is, you know, again, starting out smoking marijuana, you like getting high, it helps to reduce stress. Over time, you're looking for a better high, and eventually you may have yourself the opportunity to use heroin or opiates, and they make you feel really good. So now that becomes a drug that you become much more attracted to, and it quickly turns into a physical habit. And there are very few, I think before the interview, is there such a thing as social use? I think there are very few who are able to maintain the use of an opiate socially. I think majority of people, if they use opiates for with any frequency, they will soon become addicted to it.
We've heard the term of functioning alcoholics. Is there such an animal, a functioning opioid addict?
I think that's a much more rare animal because the addiction is a little more aggressive than the alcohol. So there probably is. Wherever there's, you know, the ability to manage this, someone has figured it out. But I don't think there are that many of those.
Can we talk about numbers? Do we have any idea how many families or how many are affected by this?
I really don't have exact numbers. There was recently some work done by the Attorney General's office, and they anticipate there's about 13,000 people in the state who are probably struggling with an opiate addiction.
So your office is the Office of Substance Abuse and Mental Health. Is this being treated as a mental health issue? Is mental health part of the addiction process that someone is had an issue that the drugs helped there?
It's being treated as a disease, and then I'll go through a number of things. I think some people started off on this course of addiction, and you see it, you know, on the advertising on television these days. You know, they had a physical pain. They started taking, you know, an athlete has a knee injury, starts taking the opiates, and then the opiate becomes controlling of their lives. That's not necessarily a person who has a significant mental health issue. They have now become physically addicted to an opiate, and they have to look at that. Now, within that context, the person who's using opiates is also now numbing a lot of other parts of their lives. So it's they're dealing with stress, they're dealing with other emotions, and they're feeling good. Okay, so it's a drug that makes you feel good. It doesn't make you feel bad. That's why you... And then you become so dependent upon that feeling that you become more and more attracted to it. So that individual may not have a significant emotional issue, but over time they will get that as a result of their addiction. You have other people who are just feeling very uncomfortable, who have mental health issues, severe depression, other things. They encounter an opiate and that makes them feel good, and they stay involved in the opiates as a result of that. So I think it works on both sides. I think you have to look at, in addressing a person who has an addiction, you have to look at their physical issues. What are they dealing with, and how can you help them with that? And their emotional issues. What are the stressors in their life that, you know, have helped them kind of continue along that path? So, yes, it is a mental health. It's a physical and a mental health issue.
I don't even know how to begin to broach this, that this became a problem, it seems, when it was the middle class, when it was the white kid, it was the mom who had a job, the firefighter or the insurance agent who started to be affected by this.
I think anytime we have an issue that starts to affect the quote-unquote middle class, the white middle class, it'll get more notoriety. I think we anticipate, rightfully or wrongfully, that bad things will happen in urban poor communities. It's when it starts hitting the middle and upper class that it becomes much more noticeable. I mean, the other thing, it also hit the actors and those who had high profile. So once you started seeing that, then people start to say, wow, this could happen to anybody. And in reality, it can happen to anybody. And it has happened to a lot of people. You know, I hear stories on a regular basis from Dr. Horton from Christiana Care, where, you know, people who have very good jobs in construction and other things come into the hospital for an unrelated issue, and they find out that they're addicted to opiates, and that's because at some point during their work career they had a back injury and the opiates kind of took control, and, you know, they continue to feel the need of relief from the back, so they continue to take the opiates, and now they have the addiction. So yes, it once it starts hitting those who have more voice, it oftentimes becomes recognized and responded to.
How cheap is an addiction?
Pretty cheap. The oxycodone is obviously expensive. The heroin is very cheap. You can get very powerful heroin for, I think it's about $5 a bag. Now, several people may have to use several bags a day, but again, you don't start that way. So if you are addicted to oxycodone, so you go to the doctor, you get a prescription for oxycodone, you start taking that, great, insurance covers that. Then the doc says, you know, we're not going to get any more prescriptions, so now you have to seek it on the streets. So when you have to seek a prescription on the streets, you know, the pill becomes much more expensive. So then you say, well, a similar drug is the heroin, so let me get that because it's cheaper and I need the relief from pain. And you'll go and get the heroin. So it's fairly cheap, again, initially fairly cheap compared to the other drugs.
What is the quality of what someone is getting, though? Is this what is causing the overdoses? Is this an issue with people not having a, I hate to say, trustworthy source of
supplies? Well, one thing we encourage, and you know, if you're going to use, go to the same dealer because you have some confidence in what they're delivering. So that's on the one side. What's happening, and it's sad, but it fits all of our economic models. It's, you know, supply and demand, and if I have a product that's better than the other product, you're going to come to me. So what happens is you have the heroin, and that's now being cut with fentanyl, which is a more potent drug. So now when I buy a bag from you that has heroin and fentanyl in it, the high I'm getting is a bit greater, more exciting. What may take me two bags now may only take me one, or variations on that theme. The problem with that is because it's more potent, if you think you normally use two bags and you buy two bags, now you may be doing the equivalent of four bags, so then you'll overdose. And that's where the concern comes. And now we've come to use this new thing, carfentanil, which is even more potent than the fentanyl, and we're cutting the heroin with that. So it's kind of, how do we entice? And that's where we get nervous. When we get the alert that we are now seeing fentanyl in the area or carfentanil, you know, the initial reaction is let the people know that so they be careful of that. But in reality, when you let people know that, it's almost like we found a better drug. Let's go find that and use it. So it's counterintuitive the way that works. So we have to be careful in just presenting that. But yes, I think what's happening, those people who are supplying drugs want to keep on, you know, want to continue to increase their market share, so they'll continue to try to have a more attractive drug, which means getting higher or feeling better.
How are the police handling this? Because this sounds like it is an evil that is here, and it is part of day-to-day life right now, and more or less like maintenance, just keeping someone from overdosing more so than take them in.
Well, I want to talk about that, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, but I'm kind of excited with what is happening with the number of police forces. We're working very closely with Newcastle County Police, and they have understood that you can't arrest your way out of this situation, that we really have to work with our communities. So they've developed this program called Hero Help, where an individual, if they are arrested for a low-level crime, the police will get them into treatment immediately if they choose to go, and will hold the crime in kind of suspension. If they complete treatment, then they'll work with the district attorney's office to possibly withdraw the prosecution for that. They also have expanded that beyond just the person who's arrested, and they said if anyone feels they have a need for treatment and you want to, you know, come into the police, to our police station, we will get you into treatment. And we've worked with them saying that, you know, we have a detox program that we fund on Kirkwood Highway, NET, and we said that we would get automatic admission in the NET for anybody who wanted to go to the police and say that they wanted help, and then we'll support their care throughout the process of change. So I think the police are realizing that there are so many people involved in low-level activities who are doing it because of an addiction, that we have to help them and not just prosecute, because if you prosecute, you don't address the issue, and they'll come back out on the street in a week or so, and they'll start doing the same thing over again. So we have to try to figure out how we help. So they understand that, but they also understand that their primary job is getting the person who may be higher level selling quantities, and they have to go after them. So they've understood the balance there. So that is critical.
What happens when there is an overdose? And I understand now Delaware has a Samaritan law. What happens when the police are called or an emergency crew is called to a scene?
Okay, so the Good Samaritan law basically says that if you are with someone and you have paraphernalia with you and the person overdoses, you can call the police and stay with that person until the police come, and you will not be prosecuted for what they find in that area. So that has been very helpful, because at times we were having people who would have their friend overdose, did not want to get arrested, so they called the police and leave the person alone. And again, oftentimes that resulted in death. So that's what the Good Samaritan law is. What happens is we now have most of our first responders carrying Narcan, which is a drug that is fairly benign drug, but once administered, it literally pushes the opiate out and it resuscitates you. Now, with that, the EMS will try to get them functioning well enough so they can get them to the emergency room so they can be cared for in the emergency room. Again, if they administer the Narcan and they become functional lucid, they can then refuse that behavior. But the EMS seems to have a fairly good handle on how to administer that so that does not happen.
This is Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with me today, Michael Barbieri, who is the director of the Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health for the Department of Health and Social Services for the state of Delaware. If you'd like information about what we're talking about today, here's the place to go. Help is here, DE, that's helpishearedelaware.com. Or you can call them. They do have an emergency number, 800-652-2929. That's 800-652-2929. Now, you said something that was confusing to me, in that an officer will try to get a person into treatment immediately, or that someone can come in and say, I am ready for treatment. Is there a bed for that person? Is there a way for that person to get treatment?
The answer is yes. The belief out there is we cannot access treatment, and we're trying to dispel that belief. We do have, we call them withdrawal management centers, where there is a 23-hour evaluation bed available, and for the most part, we have residential inpatient beds for them for withdrawal management. We also have a number of residential treatment centers that are longer term throughout the state, and they do also have beds available. So we do have capacity. It's not at maximum. Where they have the hardest time in getting admission into treatment is on our medication-assisted treatment programs. So those are our programs that provide buprenorphine or methadone. And the reason that we have a problem there is we don't have enough physicians who are practicing addictions medicine to support the clinics. In order to get the buprenorphine or methadone prescribed for you, you have to see the physician. And physicians only have limited hours, so again, we can't always be available when that person walks through the door. So that has been a problem.
I have friends who have children who are facing opioid addiction, and I have friends who have lost children to this disease. Are there signs? What should a parent, or what should a spouse, what should a child be looking for in mom or dad? And once you do see these signs, what are the resources for someone who is not in any system yet?
Okay. There are a number of signs. I mean, the physical signs of an opiate addiction is often the person seemingly involved in a conversation will nod off or begin to kind of disengage. And it almost seems like they're getting ready to fall asleep. They can't engage. They begin to scratch a little bit. They begin to be a little agitated in a chair. So that's a physical sign. I think some of the things you begin to see are they starting to miss work. If they're in school, are they starting to see deterioration in their school work? Are you starting to miss things from the house? Oftentimes they start stealing little things so they can help to pay for their habit. In fact, it was very funny, and I take that back. It was not funny at all. But one parent said that I started to miss all of my spoons, and I could never figure out what happened. But a spoon is one of the tools that they would use to, if they're injecting opiates, they would use to melt the product so that they could put it in the syringe. they start not taking care of themselves. So they may be oftentimes groomed very well. They'll start to not be groomed at all because that is not an interest. There'll be times when they're supposed to be somewhere and you have no idea where they are. So they're very absent from where they normally are going. They start to separate from friends that you know of and start to develop a whole new environment.
When you find out that your worst fears are true, how did they find help? Because you offered two options before, one the drying out and then the other medically assisted programs. Do you have research that says which one is the better route to go?
The withdrawal management is just a first step. It is never going to be the end product. It is just to get you started in a process of change. You then should be either referred to a methadone maintenance program or an outpatient program or a residential treatment program based on what your needs and circumstances are to continue your care. And I will say a very sad thing is that we're trying to offer a lot of services for those people who are struggling with the addiction. We're not nearly as good at offering those services for those people surrounding them who are affected by the addiction. We're now starting to look at doing more family education and family support groups because, and again, it is truly amazing, a mother and or wife will be experienced, or husband, will be experienced a lot of struggle in the family during this addiction process. The person will then enter into recovery and feel like, wow, they've made the big step and things are great, forgetting all that everyone else has sacrificed and gone through, and the dynamics in that relationship change a great deal. So it's very important that we start to, you know, let people accept the fact that, yes, you can be angry at the addict. Yes, they are sick, but you can be angry because they're also interfering in your life considerably, and, you know, how to work through that so that, you know, you don't deal with or you don't hold that resentment.
Is this a medical treatment or is this also a therapy treatment or a 12-step or other type of support group recovery process?
It's all of the above. I would be remiss if I said that your treatment could only consist of medication, because I don't believe that is true. I think for whatever reasons, once you start becoming addicted to a drug, it starts to change everything going on with you. So there are a lot of other emotional issues that you have to deal with, whether they were precursors to this or whether they came about as a result of the addiction. So you need the medical intervention, which would be the buprenorphine or methadone, you know, either long-term or short-term, based on what your particular needs are. You need the emotional counseling and supports. And then in order to maintain that position, because it's attractive to come back, I mean, it really does have a hold over you, you really do need to find recovery supports in the community, such as 12-step programs and things like that. We know that relapse will occur. When you're involved in a strong support system, they don't seem to occur as much.
I've been remiss because I haven't actually asked you about your own office and the programs that you have for working with law enforcement, for working with the medical professions, et cetera, and other organizations in the state. What does your office offer, and what are the programs that you're providing?
Okay. We offer a continuum of services. So we offer the withdrawal management programs. We've started those in the state, and we fund all of our system is fee-for-service. So we pay for people going into care. Because we wanted it to be easily accessible, we said, go to the front door, do not let anybody stop you, insurance or otherwise, we'll cover that, and then we'll deal with your insurance. So we tried to make it, you know, accessibility there. We offer the withdrawal management, which consists of, you know, residential or just a 23-hour evaluation or an outpatient ambulatory detox, where you would be coming back on a daily basis for medication and titrating down from the drug. We offer medication-assisted treatment programs, which are methadone and or buprenorphine programs, and they're throughout the state. And those programs will provide medication for you that is an opiate agonist, the methadone or buprenorphine, and they'll also provide the counseling. And again, you can stay in those programs as long as you need to. And, you know, be motivated to continue to improve your life skills. We also offer residential programs. We have 95 residential beds throughout the state. We have two women's programs with 16 beds each. And we have a men's program. We have PSI, the women's program, and Connections has a women's program. We have PSI that has a men's program that is 16 beds, and we have Gateway that has a men's program that is 47 beds. In addition to that, we have 32 young adult beds, and Gaudenzia has those. That's on a residential side. We then have a full continuum of outpatient services, and again, it varies in intensity of services. And we have about 23 sites throughout the state to provide outpatient services.
Is there a possibility at prevention versus treatment?
We also have a prevention unit within our system, and we do a lot of community-based prevention activities. We work with, you know, both young and old with regard to prevention, providing them information, helping them develop life skills. Most recently, we are looking at this concept of community building. So our prevention activities are focused on identifying communities where there's significant issues, going into that community and working with them and looking at what their assets are, and then seeing how we can support those with some of our prevention programs. And again, we're targeting that through some of the data that we collect through EMS, through our system, through the police.
You mentioned the community groups. Is there something that communities or individuals or groups can do? Are there programs where the lay public can get involved in some fashion with this?
I think it would be great if community groups would get educated about addiction and would look at ways that they can support their community members. It's not something you want to hide from. It's not something, well, they have that problem, I don't. Or it's not something that when you have that problem, you don't want to talk to people. But the more that the community can say, yes, this is like a person with diabetes or a heart condition, we want to help them. Here are some of the things that we can do to help. I think that would be ideal. We are trying to go out and do much more of a public relations campaign with the police and going in the communities when they have their community day and just talk to them about what's going on in the world of addictions and addictions treatment.
Do you have to face a trust issue in something like this? There are still crimes involved. Are you having any issues with trying to get the dialogue going?
Well, the biggest issue we have is stigma and, you know, the stigma of the addiction. And, you know, I don't want people to know that my son's addicted, or I don't want people to know that I'm addicted, or I don't want people to know that I've been addicted and now I'm in recovery. The more we can, you know, break through that silence, I think the more we can learn and develop, because quite honestly, the best person for an addict to speak to is a recovering addict, because they've experienced something similar to them and they can relate to them in a much better way. And you mentioned trust, and I think trust is formed much quicker with that individual than others. Can I say something? You have mentioned docs a few times. Docs are not the bad guys in this. In many ways, I think they, I know they've done a lot of really good things. Right now, we're trying to encourage more doctors to be involved with providing buprenorphine or medication-assisted treatment to individuals who might be more willing to go to a doctor than they would to go to a clinic. And then we're trying to support those doctors with helping them get those individuals connected to counseling.
If I am a doctor hearing this, or if I'm a family member, or if I have an addiction problem myself, parting words for us?
There's a lot of people who are willing to help out there, and we're working very hard to get people who are in recovery to be willing to talk to others who need some support. So if they would reach out to us, we would do everything we could to get them some assistance. If there's a doctor who would like to get some support from us, just, you know, give me a call at 302-255-9398, and we'll be very excited to be working with you, because I think a lot of people, you know, trust their physicians, and we'll talk to them, and then they can get them to the next level of help.
Again, for more information, go to helpishearede.com. That's helpishearedelaware.com. Or you can call the hotline 800-652-2929. That's 800-652-2929. My guest today, Michael Barberi, the director of the Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health for the Department of Health and Social Services for the state of Delaware. Thank you for coming in today, sir.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome back anytime. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.